for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In a world increasingly reliant on complex software, many say the threat of a devastating cyber attack is growing. The Pentagon is in the process of determining what kinds of cyber sabotage would constitute an act of war. Joining me to talk about cyber threats to both government and private industry, Siobhan Gorman. She's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Michelle Kwan, security consultant and former director for the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team. And Stuart Baker. He's an attorney in private practice, former assistant secretary for policy at the Department of Homeland Security. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Siobhan, if I could start with you, the Wall Street Journal reported on a scam perpetrated by Gmail users. Tell us about that.
Well, it was perpetrated on Gmail users.
Forgive me for saying bye.
Well, they may have used, we don't know, they may have used Gmail accounts also to perpetuate the scam. But what we know now is somewhat limited because mainly it's what Google announced yesterday, which is that there were hundreds of Gmail accounts that were sort of infiltrated by sort of perpetrators in Jinan province in China, they believe. Things in cyberspace aren't always what they initially seem to be. But what seems to have happened is there were sort of these trick emails called phishing emails.
P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G.
That were sent to hundreds of Gmail users in a rather targeted fashion because it seems that these perpetrators focused on senior U.S. officials, military officials, and officials in other Asian governments as well.
I guess what gets me about these so-called phishing attacks is that what they're asking for is the user's password.
Yes. What they're trying to do is basically get the credentials and information that you use to log into your email account. Other scams focus on getting the kinds of information you use to get into your banking account.
So, but if these are high-level people in government, if they're in private industry, surely they should know better than not to give out such information.
Indeed. But what often happens is, and we don't know exactly how this particular scam was perpetrated, but they're very sophisticated now and can even, you know, catch off guard some of the most aware users. Oftentimes now they include emails that they use emails that seem very legitimate. They seem to be dealing with an issue that, say, a U.S. government official deals with all the time. Yeah. Maybe there's an attachment that looks like it had something to do with a meeting they just attended. And so it's not necessarily like you have to be an idiot to click on one of these things.
You reported yesterday the Pentagon is in the process of coming up with some ways to deal with cyber attacks. Tell us what we know so far.
Sure. The Pentagon has been putting together its own strategy for in anticipation that the next generation of warfare, or really to some degree the current generation of warfare, is going to increasingly have elements of cyber attacks to them. And the Pentagon is worried that down the line there may be a conflict where an adversary wants to launch a cyber cyber attack that would do great harm to the United States, something that would shut down portions of the electric grid or crash subway trains or something really major. In the event of that, the Pentagon is trying to make sure that it has contingency plans for how to respond. And that's what the strategy is, providing a framework to start thinking through those contingencies.
Siobhan Gorman, she's intelligence and homeland security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And turning to you, Michelle Kwan, what are you seeing in private practice? What are industries doing to try to protect themselves?
Well, it's a broad story, and it's difficult to say that there's one thing that's being done. I think most importantly, the awareness that this is a problem has been heightened with all of the news stories that are going on, with all of the larger scale incidents that have been brought to attention. More and more people are realizing that this could happen to anyone, and it is happening to more and more people. I think what's important to note is that organizations are beginning to assess the cost of protecting themselves and assessing whether or not doing it internally, doing it for themselves, is even possible. I think as we go forward, we're going to have to look to alternatives to in-house IT, the classic everyone has their own data center and everyone takes care of their own systems. We may have to pool together our resources, lower the cost of security, which is quite expensive, both to identify the threat, to identify issues you're having, and then respond to the incidents you're having. That's a very costly process. So looking to pool together, looking towards possibly even cloud resources to address IT services in a different way.
Are you talking about pooling together within industry, or are you talking about a joint operation with the federal government?
Well, I think when you talk about a joint operation, that's always a little bit more difficult. I think what I'm mainly talking about is service IT service offerings that broaden the scope of cloud services to include security. But I do think that there needs to be a close public-private partnership that allows a sharing of information back and forth, both from government to private sector and private sector to government, because these incidents are not happening to just one sector.
Michelle Kwan, she's president of Michelle Kwan Associates. That's a security consulting firm. She's former director for the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team. Turning to you, Stuart Baker, are we doing enough yet?
No, we clearly are not. The lesson of the attacks of the last year is that no one is safe. Big security companies that should know exactly how to protect their most important assets have had their most important assets stolen by these sophisticated attacks. It's not about avoiding doing stupid things anymore. There are things you can't avoid that people are using to break into accounts. And so we're going to have to do a lot more, not just individually, but probably as a society, probably in terms of the technological architecture that we're using on the internet. If you ask me, what do you think is the solution? I do not think that more security is the solution. We can't build our walls higher and thicker and expect to survive attacks if people can attack us for free. And right now, it's almost impossible to catch the people who are doing the attacks and to punish them. And as long as that is the case, they will stand off wherever they are, Jinan province, and continue to launch ever more sophisticated attacks. We need to find ways to attribute these attacks, to identify the attackers, and then to cause them real pain.
What do you mean by real pain?
Well, ideally, we arrest them and throw them in jail.
If it's someone in another country.
In some countries, we can get cooperation from the government. And where we can't get cooperation from the government, then countries that care about this need to isolate those governments and make them pay a diplomatic price for harboring the kinds of people who carry out these attacks.
So what you're saying is that what we're doing now and the kinds of things being done now are simply not enough to either discourage the perpetrators or to stop whatever's happening. You've just got to do a lot more.
It used to be that the Pentagon said, well, no one's ever compromised our secure, secret classified networks. They don't say that anymore because it's not true anymore. Companies like RSA, which are security companies, or H.B. Gary, which are very careful about their security, have been successfully exploited by anonymous attackers.
What do you say to that, Michelle?
Well, I think it's a difficult question to answer only because as a security professional, we're always going to be in business. We're always going to be protecting our assets. The problem is that we're moving more and more of what we do to the web, to the internet, to our mobile devices. More of our lives and our businesses are now on computers. And as we do this, crime moves to the internet. As we do this, espionage moves to the internet. As we do this, more state-sponsored activities move to the internet. So as we move our lives there, so come the criminals, so come the bad behavior.
And are you saying even as we upgrade what we're doing on the internet, somehow the perpetrators are going to find ways to deal with that?
That's correct. It's the new attack surface. So we have to become diligent. We have to understand that technology will have to change. We have to be aware of what we do on the computer, what we do on the internet. We have to be aware of what we store and where we store it. We just have to do this with a much higher level of consciousness than we've done before.
Michelle Kwan, she's former director for the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk further about rules of disclosure and take your calls. Stay with us. As we talk about the growing need for more cybersecurity as the technology itself changes, here in the studio, Stuart Baker. He's an attorney in private practice, former assistant secretary for policy in the Department of Homeland Security. Michelle Kwan, she's former director for the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team, and Siobhan Gorman. She's intelligence and homeland security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. I'd like to understand, Siobhan, what the rules are when a cyber attack occurs, say, within a private company.
Well, the rules are really unclear right now, and that's one of the problems. In theory, publicly traded companies have to report what are known as material incidents to the Securities and Exchange Commission. But what a material cyber attack is very unclear. And in fact, Senator Rockefeller on Capitol Hill has been pushing the SEC to make the rules clearer for companies, to create more of an incentive for companies to actually come clean when these kinds of things happen. Generally, there is no incentive for companies to come clean on a major cybersecurity attack if it doesn't directly affect customer information. If it does, then they have to disclose it. But if it just affects their systems, they don't necessarily have to disclose it. And yet that actually could have a much bigger impact on either, sort of the security of their company, or in the case of defense contractors who are huge targets of this, U.S. national security.
So what you're suggesting is that any and all violations of cybersecurity may need to be reported.
Well, right now they don't need to be reported.
Right.
But what actually the White House and lawmakers on Capitol Hill are trying to strengthen some of these reporting requirements and make them a little bit clearer so that at least for major incidents, companies have to report them.
Michelle.
Well, I have to say, we have to be really careful the way we talk about this. I'm going to try and get away from the words come clean, because we have to remember the companies are the victims here. They're not the bad guys. The companies are trying their best to defend themselves against the bad guys.
So why wouldn't they want to divulge that their systems have been hacked into?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. You have to have a good reason to divulge. Either customer information was lost, or it will affect the price of stock in the company. It'll somehow, the stockholders need to know. There needs to be a reason for disclosing that there's a weakness in the system, because you don't want more people to attack the system because there's a weakness. Everything has to be done purposefully for a reason, not just because it's right to say, hey, this happened to me. It's not for voyeurism. It's not so that everyone can look and learn. It's really because there's a purpose. There's a reason that that information needs to get out.
Is that enough, Stuart Baker?
I'm concerned. There are laws that say if you know that personally identifiable information has been compromised, you have to tell everybody whose information has been compromised. But in many cases, you don't know exactly what was compromised. You know someone was in your system, that he packed up a bunch of data, encrypted it, and shipped it out. You don't know what happened. That's a pretty serious breach, and it probably should be disclosed. On the other hand, the Pentagon will tell you they probably get 1 million attacks a day of some sort, and there's no point in disclosing them all because most of them fail, and even the ones that succeed often are not particularly troubling. A disclosure obligation has to be pretty carefully targeted. On the other hand, there was an attack recently on RSA, which makes tokens on which the Pentagon and large parts of corporate America depend. And, you know, RSA has never told us exactly what the attackers got. I'm guessing that that's because they think it would be bad for their business if people realized just how much compromising of the security tokens occurred in that attack. And they don't have an obligation right now under law to discuss that.
Siobhan, you mentioned the Securities and Exchange Commission, where publicly traded companies are concerned. On the other hand, is there beyond the SEC a central reporting place when a system, a major system, has been hacked?
No, there isn't. The best, most effective rules are the ones the states have adopted individually for personally identifiable information. That leaves out a lot of important stuff, and so it's not a complete solution, but it also means that you're disclosing sort of generally to the world rather than to a single agency. The administration is proposing legislation that would centralize that at the federal level and probably put DHS in charge of a lot of that, and that's probably a good step.
What do you think of that, Michelle?
Well, I think it's a lot more complicated than we could probably figure out here in this hour of discussion. And I'll say there are a lot of different caveats. I'm just going to say that I actually think RSA was extremely responsible in their response. And yes, publicly, they did not say the same things that they said to their customers. And I think that's probably the responsible thing to do, to disclose to your customers and not necessarily participate in voyeurism. I'll continue to stick to that line. But what I will say is that deciding, Pat, I think we've done a good job in talking about how to disclose when PII is involved. But it's more difficult when talking about all the different kinds of information, whether it's intellectual property, whether it's medical records, all the different types of information warrant different handling. And I think to prescriptively make one rule for all information, it is a dangerous thing in itself.
And you say Senator Rockefeller is out there. What are his proposals? Would they be toward a central place of reportage or what?
Well, Senator Rockefeller, I guess, has been going after this on two fronts. One is legislatively, and he and several other members of Congress have put legislation forward that is very similar to what the White House also put forward a couple weeks ago now. And that would start to strengthen some of the reporting requirements and probably would place that at the Department of Homeland Security. And then separately, he's also asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to sort of make public some guidelines for when companies need to disclose either what they call a material cyber risk to their company, which would be more like cyber vulnerabilities that shareholders maybe need to know about, or a material cyber incident or attack. And that would be when your company actually, you know, is attacked and significant information is stolen. But it would be up to the Securities and Exchange Commission to start defining that for the companies.
And Siobhan, to what extent or what have been some of the most serious attacks that have occurred in the last few months?
Oh, in the last few months? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, probably the most significant, I would think, is the attack on RSA, mainly because a major attack on a computer security company that not only has a strong reputation for being very good on security, but actually is very good on security. I mean, that, I think, sent the message that nobody is immune from these kinds of things. And it was very interesting that RSA decided to be public about it, because it's not clear that they absolutely had to be. And that was a major step. And what has been interesting to me is actually to see the number of companies since then who have also acknowledged that they have been hit. I mean, whether it was this other security firm, H.B. Geary, that became kind of a public thing and they couldn't escape necessarily acknowledging it. But also that Lockheed Martin actually acknowledged that they had their systems breached. I mean, we actually reported almost 2 years ago now on another breach at Lockheed Martin with the Joint Strike Fighter, the Pentagon's Joint Strike Fighter program. And at the time, they would not acknowledge it. It took a year and a half for the government even to acknowledge that that had happened. So there's been an increasing willingness on the part of companies to start being a little more public about this, which is, it's an interesting trend. And I think it suggests that perhaps there is more of an acknowledgement that it's okay to have gotten breached, especially if you can talk about the measures that you're taking to deal with it.
What happened with Sony PlayStation?
I think Michelle might be able to talk about that a little bit more. But I mean, essentially, they had a breach, I believe, where, you know, tons and tons of account information was just totally siphoned off.
And
Michelle?
And the Sony PlayStation was a little bit more different. It's a little bit more difficult because it also entailed all of their customers, and it entailed an online gaming system. So it hits closer to home. It hits closer to everybody's
ordinary people.
Yeah. It's not necessary. It is a corporate breach, but it also reaches down into people's homes. So, you know, like I said before, all of these take a very interesting and different twist. And so coming up with a prescriptive way to handle it is difficult, although the Sony breach is dealing with personally identifiable information. And there are a lot of good standards for that type of reporting. What makes this even more interesting is this now crosses the international space. So now we're not just talking about something that happens in a state, not just something that happens here in the U.S., but this is something that's happening around the world. And that adds even more complexity to it, because then where is it reported to? That's not a DHS issue. You know, we have a bigger and broader issue. So this becomes more and more complex.
And expensive.
It was expensive for Sony because they essentially had to shut down their system and couldn't get revenue, couldn't provide services to users for weeks because they couldn't establish who was entitled to use the credentials that had been stolen.
So at this point, as far as anyone is concerned, here in the studio at least, there is virtually no way to protect oneself against this kind of situation, Siobhan.
Well, one interesting thing that I think companies and the government are talking about now is not necessarily trying to keep people out of your system entirely, but to figure out what are the things in your computer network that really can't be breached, that you really don't want stolen, and how is it that you protect the most important information or elements of your network, and, you know, the rest of it, you'll do the best you can, but it's not going to be a big deal if someone gets access to that. And I think that starting to segment your network and think about what truly needs to be protected may be a way to start managing some of this.
What about, though, these advertisements for security systems we hear about all the time? When I hear you say that the security systems themselves are breached, how do you separate out that which can be breached from that which can't, Stuart?
Well, I think it is absolutely the case that no individual can expect to protect themselves.
Completely,
frankly, at all. People who want to get access to your computer will send you sooner or later an email attachment that you think is safe to open. You'll open it. Your virus systems won't detect the malware, and they will own your computer. They'll be able to record all of your keystrokes, turn on, they did this to the Dalai Lama, they turned on his network cameras so they could watch people, listen to people, and record their keystrokes. It was the full 1984 package, except that the Dalai Lama had paid for the equipment. That is something that can be done to anybody who wants to get you.
Stuart Baker, he's former Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers waiting. I'll open the phones first to Roanoke, Virginia. Good morning, Matthew. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for having me on the show. I just wanted to comment on how, in order to comply with the U.S. government, Google had to create backdoor access, just wanted your guests to comment on that. That's how the Chinese were able to gain access and exploit our accounts.
Siobhan.
Well, that's not necessarily clear at this point. There was some discussion at the time, and he's actually referring to the previous hacking incident at Google from December of 2009, I think. There was some discussion that part of why they got in was because Google had to set up a system to comply with law enforcement requests. But I'm not sure that we ever got to the bottom of that.
I agree, and I think that that's focusing on a tiny issue in a sea of insecurity to say, well, I think that the government's wiretap capabilities are the source of the problem, I think misstates the issue. We have a security problem, and the government's wiretap capabilities that they have required companies to adopt are not really part of that problem.
All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Roy.
Good morning. I wanted to point out that your comment from the DHS person is totally wrong. It's actually those backdoors which are exploited to gain access. The Gmail hack actually used the Chinese used the Gmail backdoor that is required by the Patriot Act. The way security works. You've got about 500 people writing security and logs. You've got about 1 million people out there trying to break into them. The people on the outside want to break in and want to share. Anytime they find any little door, the camel's nose under the tent, that's what they share. You build those kind of back doors, that's what makes that possible. If you want to remove this threat, you need to remove the motivation. H.B. Gary got in trouble because they set up a program to mine Facebook for personally identifiable information, made a lot of the hackers mad. They went after them. PlayStation also did some bad things to their customers. There's better ways you can do this. Being honest and open organizations is the best way to protect yourself.
Michelle.
Well, I'll have to say that it's a really difficult situation. There are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of methods. You know, when you're talking about hacktivism, you're talking about the state-sponsored activity, you're talking about fraud, you're talking about organized crime. You know, why these things happen and what their motivations are, what you do to attract people to do that to you, that's a psychological issue all in itself and a very difficult one to address.
There are an awful lot of people who simply don't like closed doors.
If I can add to that, I think that's a counsel of surrendering to the lynch mob. But this was an attack designed to punish people for views they'd expressed, and that's not something you should surrender to.
All right. Short break. More of your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Historian David McCullough chronicles 19th century Americans who went to Paris to fulfill their ambitions, how their experiences changed our nation. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. We're talking about computer security, cyber security. Here's a tweet from someone who asks, is anyone bothered by the fact that every panel member on cybersecurity will profit from increased fears about security? I'm not sure I see you profiting, Siobhan.
No, my paycheck stays the same regardless of what the cybersecurity status is.
How do you respond to that, Michelle?
Well, that's like saying that doctors are profiting from being doctors. I mean, someone has to do this work, and you know, it is my career. It is what I've chosen to do for my life.
And Stuart?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'll be better off if people spend more on security. I'll probably be better off defending lawsuits from bad security than good security.
Yeah.
And I do think this is a sort of deflection of the issue. People don't want to think about it, so they say, well, the people who are giving me this message are doing it out of self-interest. I don't think that's the case. We really have a serious problem.
Let me ask you, Michelle, during the break you were talking about your own company and how you went fishing within your company. Tell me what you did and why.
So I teach at George Washington University, and I teach the Cyber Corps students. Those are the students that are being trained to work in cyber for the government. And one of the students had a research project where he put together a phishing email, and he phished a large group of people, all training to be cyber professionals, and thinking, you know, a few would take the bite. And every single person, including me, took the bite. It just proves that phishing is a difficult thing. The email can look really, really, really real. They'll use names of people that you know, people in your department. It could say something that pertains to needing information in order for you to get your paycheck. It could say that they're updating their address book. I mean, it could be something very, very real that you would want to know more information about.
Siobhan.
Well, people also don't realize how much information is openly available on the internet. I mean, there are PowerPoint presentations from government conferences and things like that that often include all the attendees' names and emails. And what oftentimes these phishing attempts will do is just grab that and then send people emails directly related to the conference. And they know that the people are likely to click on it because they feel that it's relevant to them.
Tell me about Stuxnet, Siobhan.
Sure. Stuxnet is a computer worm that attacks computerized control systems. And these so-called SCADA control systems are in many different things, whether it's our electric grid or subway systems, things like that. They also happen to run nuclear facilities. And what happened was this worm was launched, and apparently about 60% of the infections turned out to be in Iran, and Iran eventually acknowledged that their Natanz nuclear facility had trouble with their centrifuges, which they then attributed to Stuxnet.
Is that the end of the story?
Well, no, because nobody knows who perpetrated this, and there's a lot of suspicion and very little proof.
And where is the suspicion directed?
The suspicion is directed at the Israelis, perhaps with American assistance. And that's a very interesting accusation. Obviously, Iran has made that accusation, but there have been researchers who have looked at the nature of the virus, and some of them say that there are signs that it could have come from Israel. What would be interesting, and the reason why I'm a little bit skeptical of U.S. involvement, is that if your target is Iran, to only hit it 60% of the time would actually be a real problem for the U.S. to have been involved in something like that, because some of the infections were also in the United States, and they were in Indonesia and other places. And so that's why it will be interesting if we ever figure out who's behind it, because if it was targeted at Iran, it only hit the target 60% of the time.
Well, but with the guidelines that the Pentagon is developing, could Stuxnet, if in use, be considered an act of war?
If it were in use against the United States and the U.S. could determine who actually was behind it, I would be surprised if that weren't at least considered, put up for consideration to decide whether or not it was an act of war, at least a use of force against the United States.
Well, I think that's the real question. I think the definition of what the act of war in cyberspace has not been clearly defined yet. In the physical world, that has been clearly defined. And I think that's the issue is what are those thresholds And
but couldn't Iran consider it an act of war?
I think they do. I wouldn't be surprised if they're plotting revenge. One of the things that is significant about Stuxnet is it's the first state use of malware to sabotage a significant facility in another country. And the Iranians are not technically incompetent. We're running the risk, and Israel's running the risk, and Germany and other countries, that there will be an attack of a similar sort against our SCADA systems, which include all of our power systems.
But there was also a report earlier this week that two researchers in their own home were able to replicate Stuxnet. Where does that leave us?
Well, I think that a lot of times, and I think we've seen this with other types of weapons in the past, that governments will develop things and eventually, people in the private world will find ways to replicate them. And especially with something like software, if you can look at it and take it apart, then there's no reason to think that a savvy technology geek couldn't then figure out how to replicate something when kind of given the roadmap, so to speak.
Here's an email from Derek, and it goes to something you said, Michelle. He says, I work for one of the world's largest IT hosting companies and frequently deal with cybersecurity threats. I want to comment on the notion that companies are the victims, not the enemy. When speaking of those targeted with cyber attacks, unfortunately, Derek goes on to say, such companies are frequently both. Many companies will not sufficiently prioritize security and will make only minimal effort to address issues.
Unfortunately, that is the truth. The largest problem I think we have is having executives in large companies who run the companies who aren't computer savvy, who don't clearly understand the threat, not prioritize the risk and not take the appropriate measures for protection.
Out of ignorance.
A lot of it comes out of ignorance. A lot of it comes out of an inability to balance that risk, to actually assess it. They'll look at the risk and say, well, this hasn't happened to me yet. And that's a really difficult one to handle. And it happens in almost all organizations where security professionals have to justify protections or upgrades or even all different ways of securing the system, because it's hard to articulate what could happen. You're always working with a what could happen. I mean, our largest tool right now is to take an incident and say, this happened. I guarantee you, once an incident happens, that corporate CSO then has a much larger budget to deal with after the incident. But we have to be able to deal with the incident before it happens.
To Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Diane. I'm glad that the panel brought up Stuxnet because although the SEC, PlayStation, and Google are important companies to think about in terms of cybersecurity, the cybersecurity on the electric power grid in North America is considered of grave interest to the function of our society, and the federal government has put together a number of regulatory compliance requirements that require operators and utility owners to enforce certain types of cybersecurity standards. It's largely the opinion of these people and these utilities that the organization NERC that is responsible for enforcing those standards is not doing a very good job. This has been a recent discussion on Capitol Hill, and there are a lot of things going on. I'd like to hear from your DHS panel member as to whether he believes NERC is doing a good job and whether FERC is doing a good job as the appointing authority for the ERO.
All right. Thanks for calling, Stuart.
Very broadly, I think we have a long way to go in that area. One of the things that Stuxnet taught us is that as bad as IT security is on our Windows machines and our networks, the security for our power grid is much worse. It's never been part of the planning to ensure security. It's about making sure you can turn on the power again. And that means they have, for example, default passwords that they never change. Everybody knows them because they want to make sure that hundreds of people have the ability to go into a particular facility and get started. So all of the attention has been on reliability, getting the power back on, and not about the possibility of attackers. So we have a very serious problem there. And we also have a terrible regulatory climate in which the states and to some extent the power companies have said, we want to be regulated at the local level, the state level. The federal government should butt out. FERC's authority is very limited. NERC's authority is quite limited. And their ability to actually make sure that these cybersecurity standards, which aren't particularly strong, are actually being implemented is quite limited. At the same time, instead of focusing on that, we have been devoting billions of dollars to what we call the smart grid, which actually expands our cyber vulnerability quite substantially. And very little cybersecurity has been built into these smart grid initiatives. So we are actually in the process of making ourselves more vulnerable, and we're not solving the regulatory problems that might produce a little bit better security.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Siobhan, I know you want to add to that.
Well, yes, my understanding is that when NERC, which is sort of a semi-self-policing effort on the part of the electric industry, started to require electric companies to, you know, define, I think they were their cyber components of their organization, and then say that those components had to meet new standards, the vast majority of the companies suddenly found that they didn't have any cyber resources that they had to protect against these standards, even though everybody knows that electricity is incredibly reliant these days on the internet. And so they've basically been looking for ways to get around having to deal with these new standards.
To Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning, Diane. I would like to ask, I know this is fiction, TVs and movies hire hackers to go back into the system. Is our government like looking for really excellent hackers, paying them big money to come to the other side and find the bad hackers?
What about that, Michelle?
Is the government hiring hackers?
It's got to be hiring people who know how to break into systems in order to make sure that their system isn't broken into.
Well, and that's a part of learning security, is learning how to break it. You learn how to fix it. You learn how to defend against people who are breaking into it. That indeed is a part of learning how to do this. I think there's probably somewhere in the world where someone who did something bad got hired for having that creativity. That is the way of the past. I'm not so sure that that's a good avenue for employment today.
Well, here's an email from Jeffrey who says, what protections do the antivirus companies take to ensure that their antivirus companies don't go home at night and write the very viruses they're paid to stop the next day? Stuart?
I'm skeptical that that happens. I'm more worried that the antivirus software really doesn't identify many of the products that are out there now.
And that's exactly the question from Facebook from Tom, who says, why is antivirus malware detection just another commodity to be bought and sold? Why doesn't the government declare cybersecurity as a public interest and make free, state-of-the-art antivirus and malware detection tools available to every computer? Now you get a free, minimal version that works well, and one that works well only if you pay extra.
Well, I think this opens up a really interesting question. Two interesting questions. One, can we create an antivirus that works well? I think the whole premise of antivirus is you already have it. You're already infected. So I think we need to look to some new technologies.
You're saying you've already got viruses out there to protect against.
If
they're
not
working.
That's right. If they know about the signature, then the exploit has already happened.
All right.
So that I think we need to look to some new technologies. The other issue is you get nothing for free. If the government offers something for free, then someone else has to pay for it somewhere. And, you know, that we have to keep thinking about that nothing's for free. It just doesn't work that way.
We'll talk to Congressman Ryan about the budget and whether he wants to include something for that in there. Thank you all so much. Michelle Kwan, Siobhan Gorman, Stuart Baker, and please be careful on your computer. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.